Vincent.
It's early days, Wes.
It's been a whirlwind. I'll send you his Instagram. We have a very strong connection.
Is he a right winger?
Well, I only voted for him twice.
Oh my God!
Well, hi everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Cheppardini. Thank you very much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Hope your week is going well. Hope you're smiling. I hope the sun is shining. And if you've ever woken up one day, you're just walking down the street or in your car, and you just think to yourself, man, wouldn't it be so great if everybody thought the way I did? Wouldn't things go a lot smoother? My boss, the guy at the coffee place. It's not going to happen, but you know, the best we could do is we can learn to live with each other, compartmentalize, have a good time, and just, you know, just be cordial, casual, and in common circles with people, because that's all we are. We're not going anywhere. Anyway, long-winded introduction, but I'd like to welcome to the podcast writer and director Eric Bork. We're going to be speaking about the elephant in the room. It's not me. We're not talking about red states and blue states. This is me. I'm wearing an orange shirt, Oklahoma State. But Eric, forgive my rambling. How are things in your world?
Oh, things are going great. It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. Sure thing. You know, when you popped up on my radar, I just saw a Band of Brothers and I thought, wow, nothing says quality programming more than HBO, Spielberg, Tom Hanks, Band of Brothers, and top of the list, Eric Bork, who was very integral in writing a lot of those things that have stuck with us. Winters, and makes me want to go back and watch it all over again. But why don't we just, a couple getting to know you questions. What was the first time you picked up a pen and said, you know what, I got a story to tell, and I don't care if it's good or not, but I just can't stop myself.
Yeah, I don't first, thanks for that intro and the kind words about Band of Brothers, which I was lucky to be part of the team of. I didn't really get into writing as a kid. I decided to go to film school in college to study film production for my bachelor's. So that's where writing really started, because although it was not mainly about writing, there was a little bit of screenwriting involved, and I was not good at it, but I was interested in it. And, you know, there were certain movies, certain writers that had an influence on me, you know, prior to that, but it was really kind of a college thing where I kind of moved in that direction.
Well, which writer specifically piqued your brain and said, you know, there's detail here, there's interest and intrigue?
I mean, I really liked the movie The World According to Garp, which came out when I was in high school, which was written by Steve Tesich from the John Irving novel with Robin Williams, directed by George Roy Hill. That movie had a big impact on me. It was about a writer whose mother is also a writer. And my mother actually was a nonfiction writer as well. That movie was big for me. I was kind of into the late 70s Woody Allen stuff, late 70s, early 80s. You know, I was a big fan of The Catcher in the Rye. Those were some of the initial influences, writers and projects that got me interested in writing.
Well, I remember specifically in 10th grade, my English teacher had the entire class write a last chapter to John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men and trying to imagine where the characters go. And I think that that's one of the beautiful things about being a writer is that, you know, things are not confined to the page. Things live on the page and they can develop on page, but there's always this, you know, the world that takes you outside of that. So were there any stories that were cut short for you and you're thinking to yourself, man, I just wish I could, you know, see more of Robin Williams in this or whomever.
Oh, you in movies that I liked. Oh, that's an interesting question. I've never thought about that before. I can't say off the top of my head. I can think of movies where, I mean, there's certainly movies where you like want to rewatch them or you can't get enough of them. But none that I could think of where I was like, I wish it went on further and I wonder what happened to them later. Although I think you naturally do in a movie that's powerful, want the characters stay with you and you kind of want to know where they went after the movie. And the movie that we're here to talk about, The Elephant in the Room, that's certainly the case because it ends in such a way that I won't give it away, but where people are wondering and we discuss after they've screened it, what do we think happens to this potential couple? Often happens in romantic movies, I guess, because, you know, a lot of times they end with, okay, they're going to give it a shot, but is it really going to work out long term or not? We don't know.
Yeah, you're speaking The Graduate, Elaine and Dustin Hoffman's character sitting there like, oh crap, what next? What now?
That's a great example. They really lean into it in The Graduate. Yeah, but even in movies with a super happy ending, you kind of wonder, is this couple gonna really work? Like Jerry Maguire was one I felt that way about. I really love the movie, but it's like, is it really gonna work between the two of them? Just because he had her at Hello and everything.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up. That reminds me of something I wrote when I started my website. It was all this theorizing, ways that movie studios could offset prices of movie tickets for patrons and, ideas for sequels and stuff. But there was one article I wrote which I had the idea of like what happens after the credits, and something like something entirely world-changing like Transformers. Just because you save the world, just because you're friends with autonomous robots, does that mean the relationship is going to work out? It just makes you wonder all these things, like do Kim Cattrall and Jack Burton, I mean, they don't end up at the end of Big Trouble in Little China, but yeah, it begs the question of like what happens. But it's also beautiful too, because when you think about episodic TV, you get the ch chance to extend the story and say what's next, and maybe there's another season that picks it up. So. I don't know where I was going with that, but talk to me about your experiences in the world of TV.
Well, yeah, I got my start working for Tom Hanks as one of his assistants, actually, back when he was doing Forrest Gump and Philadelphia. And I initially thought I might write for sitcoms, half-hour comedy shows, and I wrote a couple of sample scripts, which is what you did in those days to show you could do it for shows like Friends and Frasier. And I had an agent and I was starting to get meetings, and the idea was I'm going to probably go work on one of those shows as a staff writer if I'm lucky. Instead, Tom Hanks read those scripts and basically ended up offering me a big promotion to help him ultimately write and produce first the miniseries From the Earth to the Moon for HBO, and then later Band of Brothers, and then a bunch of other projects you never heard of because they never got produced, but we worked on. So he really gave me my start, but ironically, not so much in comedy, but in these historical miniseries. But eventually, I started pursuing more comedic stuff on my own, and pitching them and selling ideas for shows to networks. And a lot of times, they don't end up producing them or putting them on the air, but you get paid to write them and so forth. And then eventually, decide I want to write and direct movies, which is what I this you know this new project, The Elephant in the Room, was my first feature film that I've written and directed. But prior to that, I've had a lot of experience in television. I've worked on staff on some other people's shows, worked on those miniseries, and then I developed quite a few projects where I had the idea for a show, I maybe wrote the pilot script, and then that was as far as it went. Never got one on the air that I created solely by myself.
Well, when you talk about sitcom, which is you could kind of literally go anywhere you want within the limits of a character, but then you talk about something like From the Earth to the Moon or Band of Brothers, that really has a framework of actual events, and even if there's some fictitious elements, do you feel that which one do you lean towards more? Something that is a little more structured, or something that is so freeform?
I think as a writer, it seems like it would be easier to write true story adaptations, but it's actually harder in some ways because you're stuck with the true story and the true facts, and you're limited to how much you can move beyond that. So I tend to be more interested in writing fictional stories, although I'm best known for a nonfiction story, Band of Brothers, which is based on a book, which is based on true events. So while yes, we did do a little bit of fudging of how things really happened, for the most part, we were really trying to just dramatize what had really happened. And in some stories like Band of Brothers, you're lucky because what really happened is so compelling and can work as storytelling on screen without so much intervention from the writers, although there's still quite a bit. Because when you think about it, we write every word of dialogue, we make it up because we don't know what they said. Like, we don't know the details. We only know the broad strokes of what they've told, as the history. But still, a lot of times, the true stories are the gulf between what the history gives you and what you need as a screenwriter is big enough that it can be problematic. And although I would do it again in my own work that I've done just on spec or independently, I tend to always gravitate toward fiction.
Speaking specifically about going from the page, where in a way you are the director of the words, and then having it handed off to somebody to pull together and produce. When you do take the mantle, or you do take the helm for something like The Elephant in the Room, how much do you feel that it is a step in a, not to say a different direction, but it's like a whole new ball game for you? I mean, crafting the words is one thing, but how difficult it is to now execute in a three-dimensional form with living people and such.
Yeah, it's a huge undertaking compared to writing, which is also a big undertaking. But if you just write the script and hand it off, not only are you not creating the finished product, you're not you often you're not involved at all in the actual making of the thing. You just wrote it. The biggest difference is just, having to manage this big process, raising the money or finding someone that wants to spend the money to make whatever you're doing can be a big part of it, which it was for this because it was independently financed. No one company was financing this movie. And then, the whole idea that you have to hire and choose cast and crew and make all these decisions about things that are going to be part of the production, part of the set, where you're going to shoot it, the locations, but also the production design, wardrobe. Like there's a bazillion decisions that you have to make. And a lot of responsibilities, but it's good in terms of the freedom. It's first of all, it's stimulating and fun to work with a team of people who you're kind of in charge of, and it's also rewarding to have the control. In other words, you're deciding. You might have written it, but you're deciding exactly what's going to be on screen. You're choosing who's going to be in it. You're directing their performances. You're editing and overseeing the editing, which as writers, you often don't get to do any of those things. Because there's a director or a higher level producer or writer, other writer involved, and you're just, writing the script and that's it.
Well, speaking specifically about your strengths and what you want to see, how you execute your vision, there's a phrase that goes, dictate results, not means and methods. So do you find yourself on one side of the fence? Like, can you give these words to somebody, say, here's what I want, do it? Or do you feel like you still need to be in the means and methods, the weeds of that?
Yeah, I agree that that you don't want to get involved in their means and methods too much. That it's especially working with creative people, whether it's actors or an editor or even even a cinematographer, a composer, certainly, all of whom work for you as a director, but you can't do what they do, and you need them to bring their creative spark to it. That if you get too much in the way by trying to dictate the means and methods, it will tie them up and make it hard for them to do that. So I mean, I think it's most obvious when you're working with actors because you can't just tell them what the performance should look like, what the outcome of the, I mean, on one hand, you want a certain outcome, but you can't even really tell them the outcome, let alone the means and methods. It's more like the best directing, I think, is when you're encouraging a different way of looking at the scene, a different way of thinking about what it is their character's going through or wanting, so that they can use their own means and methods to come up with an outcome in their performance. That is an outcome you're happier with. So with creative people, it's almost like you can't dictate the outcome or the means or methods. It's like you know the outcome you want, but you can't specifically, you can't get exactly the outcome you want, nor can you often describe it to them in a way that's helpful to them. It's more that you have to find a way to kind of almost manipulate it into them being able to access their creative ideas to get to an outcome that is closer to the out an outcome that you're happy with.
I see what you're saying. And I've heard directors do that as a means of they would have organized script readings, or they would have the actors interact with each other as if they were characters, write each other notes and stuff to sort of, help kind of immerse them in the world. So it's less about stand on your mark, say the lines. It's more of, it comes through them based on what you've asked or what you've given them with the material, and you become their muse. So, really cool stuff. Really cool stuff. Talk to me about the setting of the story. It's very small, takes place in COVID times. Having a, let's just call it a trio of characters when there's actually a couple more people than that involved. How does this, how did you feel that this was necessary for the framework and structure?
Well, so just for people that don't know, the movie we're talking about, The Elephant in the Room, is about it's a political love story where the challenge in the way of a potential romantic relationship is they have opposite political views. So you have this December 2020, you have this young single woman who's lonely after a breakup. She's living with a guy who's a housemate she doesn't really know but wants to get to know as a friend. And then she meets this guy that she's interested in possibly dating, and then finds out he voted for Trump, and she's a progressive, and that's a problem for her. And the rest of the movie is where's that going to go? And it's mostly set in her house where she's living with this housemate, and the guy, the potential boyfriend type guy, comes over for various dates and experiences at the house. and it's pretty much all set in that one place, which, it makes sense because it's still kind of quarantine late 2020 times where people didn't go out to restaurants on dates and things as much. Also, it helps for us budgetarily to shoot all in one location is cheaper than having to shoot in a bunch of locations, let alone having to pay to take over like a restaurant or some other setting and have a bunch of extras in the background. All those things cost money. So this was a micro budget or ultra low budget movie where certain decisions were made for both creative and realism issue reasons, but also for budgetary reasons. So part of setting it in that time period and having the story be just these three people really in this one place was a budgetary reason, but it's justified by the fact that it's believable during COVID that a romantic comedy could play out in such a contained space without a lot of people together.
And I also think that the having that smaller scale, it allowed these characters, and I credit the actors, Sean Clare, Dominic Burgess, and Alyssa Lemperis. They're very charismatic and they're charming in their own ways. They have, as Vincent Lee and Martin, I think everyone's going to gravitate towards Martin, who's kind of, he's less a referee, but just more of like, I would say he's almost the audience surrogate, just watching the tennis match go back and forth. But one of the main themes that is in the film, how Leah and Vincent talk to each other, it's about compartmentalizing. Are you able to see past, and are you able to see past a person's differences enough to sort of go, to get along with them? And so it's pretty remarkable just seeing that sort of human environment in a, I would call it a microcosm, very small scale.
Yeah, compartmentalizing, it comes up in the movie, the idea that, can you date someone with different views because you're going to compartmentalize the views and just focus on the things that you like about them, which she has a hard time doing, even though she experiments with it, because to her, the idea that he's a Trump voter is a non-starter. How could I date someone with those views? To her is impossible, but she also thinks maybe I could impact his views. So that's one reason to hang in there. And for now, put aside this fact that long term it seems like a problem and see what happens if I give this guy a chance, but also kind of try to spar with him a bit.
The word you used is something I was myself I was struggling with because I was just trying to think of what is it more what's more truthful? Is it changing somebody or impacting somebody? Or maybe better, what is more possible to change somebody or impact somebody? And I think it just the sort of understanding of a view is probably easier than accepting it because at least you know where the person's coming from. And again, you sort of like as Jim Brown said in Any Given Sunday, you get along and then you go along. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think changing and impacting people is one of the big themes or questions of the movie. Should you try to impact someone? How far should you go? Should you accept people and accept yourself exactly as you are? So all three of these characters grapple with that for themselves and with the others. The question of, am I trying to change them? Is that a good idea? What if it would make them healthier? What if they want to change on some level? How much can I or should I try to change them or change myself? What are the pros and cons of just trying to like let someone be exactly as they are versus encouraging or impacting them to maybe consider changing in some way? Because it's not only about the political thing, it's also her relationship with her housemate. She's impacting him. He's trying to get maybe more physically fit. And so she's kind of like trying to impact both of them in different ways. And she's kind of a fixer character. But she sort of learns over time that that kind of like blows up in her face a bit to be too much of an attempted fixer. At the same time, she does make a positive impact on both of them, and they both make a positive impact on her, arguably. And so, if she had never tried to impact either of them in the first place, would any of those good impacts have happened? So it's not a cut and dry, you should or you shouldn't try to do any of those things. It's more an exploration of the possibilities and possible consequences for these particular people around those issues.
And Martin has a line in the film where he tells Leah, he goes, "Now you have two broken men you're trying to fix." And so it's the idea that you have to take a step back and you have to go, well, given any topic, given any situation, who is right, who is an authoritarian, and who, I think it comes down to just trying to come to common ground. Again, if you like chocolate and I like vanilla, you're probably never going to sway me, but at least I can understand why you like it, and we can have an understanding as opposed to just saying, I like everything about you but this one thing, and That's causing me to write you off completely. You kind of like throw out the baby with the bathwater. So, interesting study is the dynamic of this film. And if
Thank
I
you.
demonstrate, this came from a personal place. You actually had friends who influenced this.
Well, somewhat, yeah. I mean, around 2016, I started feeling that polarization was this really key issue that I cared about, but and I also was kind of on one side of the political divide, and I had a good friend who was on the opposite side. When Trump got elected the first time, that led to a lot of like trying to understand why someone would think the opposite of what I thought politically, and learning that it was more, they were more complicated and complex and thoughtful than I might have imagined, because I had bought into the kind of m the myth that polarization tries to sell us, which is people with opposite political views are all the same as each other, and they're all super extreme. The most extreme version you can imagine is what they all are and must be. Without like really delving into it any further, we like assume that because we listen to polarized voices, both political leaders and some media figures that are incentivized to, I think, promote polarization, where they kind of want us to feel just sort of angry and judgmental and depressed toward people that have the so-called unacceptable opposite views of ours, and that everything is binary. Whereas in reality, people aren't that binary, and most people, have more they agree on that you might not think they would, despite having supporting opposite candidates. So the movement against polarization is a movement toward listening and finding common ground, not necessarily changing your political views at all, but with the people in your life who might have different ones, humanizing them and being curious instead of completely shut down and sort of wall building. And so in the process of making the film, I got partnered with some organizations and individuals who are really doing that work in the public sphere and supported the movie and helped me, rewrite the script in such a way that the characters would hopefully not be polarizing to audiences on either side, because that's the opposite of what I wanted to do, and also be believable and likable. Those were some of the biggest challenges with the script, is to try to walk that balance so that in theory you could be of any political persuasion and still get emotionally involved in the story and sort of like the people, even though you probably disagree violently with one of them in terms of politics.
Well, if you do disagree with them, you can always hook, uppercut, front kick, which I find funny. Was that a P90X? I similarly did those videos.
Well, P90X3, which was the third one and the easiest because it was only a half hour, Tony Horton's Beachbody.com. Yeah, home video exercise routine. I did that for a while. And there's one that's, I think, called MMX, Marshall, mixed martial, whatever. And so there's all these sequences. One of them was hook, uppercut, front kick. And we put that in the movie. Yeah.
Well, if you can put yourself in the film as either Leah or Vincent, and not speaking politically, not speaking about ice cream flavors, but is there a situation that you can find yourself in where you've found that your views have changed along the way due to a conversation, a podcast, a fortune cookie, something that is like, hi, okay, I see it now.
Yeah, I mean, my views have changed a lot over the years and gone all over the place to some extent. And it's really just based on where I'm getting information from and information and opinion from, what I'm immersing myself in. Because I don't know what's really happening outside my zone of experience. I only know what is reported to me and what people conclude about those things and how much I research and look into it and who I trust. And how much time I want to spend on all that. Honestly, I mean, I think part of the reason why we tend to be in one tribe or the other is it's just easier to be like, feel like, okay, this side is basically my tribe. And what they say, I'm probably going to mostly agree with. So I'm just going to watch the stuff that's about that, because that feels better than watching people that bother me and anger me or depress me, right? So I just watch those people, and I have the kind of safety of, well, at least I have this tribe that all feels kind of the same way, and I think we're right and they're wrong, right? So, I don't know that there's any one single issue that I could say my views have like violently changed or gone from like one extreme to the other. But what I have d been doing for myself is trying to work on, if I'm in an echo chamber, try to come out of it, try to notice, critical thinking, notice the source of whatever it is I'm reading or watching and what their bias seems to be like. And if there's any source that is seems like their business model is to just make me look at the worst things about the other side all day, every day, and always agree with our side and always disagree with their side and characterize everything in the most extreme way. Chances are that's not giving me the full story. So if you start to pull out of that and start looking around and asking questions as if you didn't have preset love for them and hatred for them or whatever, and we're just like, let me just look at individual issues. It takes a lot more time and work, but like you want to look at one individual issue and investigate it outside of echo chambery sources on either side, it might cause you to go, oh, there's a more nuanced view I now have about that one thing. This has happened to me quite a bit since I've tried to be less polarized. And I think, nuance is everywhere and everything's gray. And we want to make it black and white, binary, and simplistic. And most issues aren't. I mean, any one particular event or statement or policy might be, but for the most part, the larger issues have multiple sides and perspectives and complicated reasons why they're not just easily and obviously resolved one way or another over time. So I try to dig into that stuff. And when I do, it makes me go, oh, I didn't know this part, or I never heard this opinion about it. So now I can hold conflicting opinions at once that other people have had that both make sense. And where's mine fall? Well, probably somewhere maybe in the middle. It's not always just completely pinned over to one side on every single thing.
Completely agree. I was going to call back to my many days of commuting here in Dallas. I listened to talk radio in the mornings, and I found myself every time, as days went on, I was infuriates me so much this, but that's what you're saying. It's the echo chamber that you need to realize I might not be getting the whole story. And so it caused me to take a step back and see, okay, I make better formations and opinions and belief. So I'm with you on that. But what I found beautiful about the film is while Vincent is watching a show like Rachel Maddow and taking notes and trying to show Leah that he wants to understand where she's coming from and kind of cross that bridge, there's the discussion that they have where they talk about topics and music plays over, which I think is great because in a sense, you don't need to know what they're saying to see that they're, making progress. And so I'd like to talk about, give you an opportunity to think about creative choices like that, where you make it more of a visual thing and less about a concrete, dialogue, so to speak.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I realized early on, look, it's a comedy. We want people to enjoy the movie. It's not fun to watch people argue too much about politics, and especially if you're trying to get people to like both characters. If one of them continues to spout things you violently disagree with, you're gonna have a harder time liking them. So I want to keep that to a minimum while still presenting them both as believably and realistically on two different sides. So there's one conversation fairly early on where you get at least a sprinkling of their opposing views on like one issue. And enough to realize, okay, he pretty much agrees with like the Trump side on most issues, if not all. She agrees with the Biden side on most issues, if not all, et cetera. And then later in the movie, when there's another like larger free form, let's really have it out and talk about a bunch of issues, this is what you're referring to. Instead of hearing all of that, I had this idea that we would play like the 1812 overture over it and just see them gesticulating and talking and not know what they're saying, but we get the gist of it because it'd be more fun. It'd be a little bit comedic and we don't have to listen to every single issue that they're debating. But we're basically just getting the message of, oh, they're still far apart on a lot of issues and it's exhausting to like talk it through. So that was in the script. When we actually shot it, I decided, well, let's also script or even improv some issues from the talk about in case I decide not to do the music thing. So we did that and we shot them all giving opinions on various issues. Some I think I pre-scripted, some I just let them improv. But eventually in the editing room, we liked the music thing. The editor and I still was work, so we ended up going with that.
I think it works out so much better. It makes it a little more, like you said, it's more of a rom-com element. It's universal because you don't dwell on anything specifically. And I'm glad you mentioned that you shot it, or that you shot it with the intent that there would be dialogue. Because I remember my social studies teacher told me in 10th grade, she goes, "If you're ever at a party and you don't know what to say, just start saying mashed potatoes, like without words, because it moves your mouth in a way that it looks like you're saying something." So I wasn't sure if you had Sean and Alyssa say things like, gobbledygook or whatever, because they you knew it was going to be covered over with music. So
Yeah.
anyway, tips for the future. Well, I think that you have a lot of passion in your voice. The film is definitely a labor of love, and you look at it from the view of a consumer or somebody in the audience. What would you say is your proudest achievement of it? Whether it's a scene or what a character said, or something that you look back and you go, "So glad we got that." You know, that's what I was aiming for the whole time.
There's moments throughout the film that I feel that way about. It's been such an ongoing process. I mean, the actors, the editor, Brian Colvin, the composer, Alex Taylor, so many people put so much great work into it that it's sort of like, my main answer to that is really just the fact that I still like watching the film, because I'm notoriously very critical of my own work, but I'm more convinced than I usually am that I maybe did something pretty good, meaning that a lot of people would vibe with it. Doesn't mean everybody, of course, but my wife still wants to show it to friends when they come over to visit, and she's seen it 10 times. That's a good sign, because she can be very critical of my stuff too, in a good way. We just showed it to an audience in New York City a couple of weeks ago, screening about 80 people at a film center. And people were laughing, and people were making even emotional sounds during the movie. Like, I just could tell they were really engaged with the story and characters and felt something. I mean, that's the most gratifying thing in the end, is it's strangers you don't know who don't, aren't just sitting there going, "Oh, when is this going to be over?" I mean, maybe some of them were, but I really felt most of them weren't. And afterwards, they want to ask a lot of questions. They want to discuss what happened to the movie. That's the thing I'm really most grateful for, as opposed to any one specific thing in the movie. Although, if we went through scene by scene, I could probably find a bunch of those where I'm like, I'm so glad the actor that played Martin said, "Hey, I have an Invisalign. Should I take it out on camera? Would that be funny while we're eating pizza?" And he did, and it was hysterical, and we kept it in the movie. There were a lot of little things like that, that came up along the way.
Well, one of the things that sort of sucked me in is where Alyssa is leaving the room, leaving the kitchen after speaking to Martin for, I think, the first time, and she does this sort of like kind of Roy Rogers goofy kind of walk. And I'm just curious, did you envision a lanky kind of character like that, or was that Alyssa bringing something to Leah? What these sort of moments that characters created.
Yeah, that was 100% Alyssa. And that's what's so great about, I mean, they say, like, there's that cliche that, like, directing is 90% casting. There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the stuff that they brought like that was great. She had so many comedic things like that that were just body languages or way of saying things that are just delightful. And some of them were like little improv things that, made it into the movie because they were charming and they were funny and they weren't scripted, but they were within the script, adding things that were just organically, very useful. Also, in that same scene, like, Dominic Burgess, who plays Martin, is at the table with these headphones on, and some of the business he does with the headphones on and off, he just came up with, and it's hysterical because she's like, "I'm sure you don't want to hear about my, like, romantic problems." And he nods and he puts his headphones back on, which is so funny and beyond anything I thought about. I mean, I had him having headphones, but I didn't expect that. And so, there's just little things like that, little pieces of business that can really makes a moment funnier and better and warmer than you even envisioned. And all three, well, all six of the actors brought me those things on a regular basis.
It's the gift that keeps on giving the whole run time. Well, Eric, thank you so much for your time. Everyone, check out The Elephant in the Room. Eric, thank you so much for your time, and we will catch you next time.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
So, what do you like about him?
Look, I don't think he's a nice guy.
Okay.
He's just more open about it, which is refreshing.
That is refreshing to you?
Tell her you think the election was legit. She'll eat that up.
I should be clear. I don't do casual.
I'm a bit old-fashioned in that way. I'm closed for business. The door is locked, the chain is on, there's armed security out front.
We can't just leave it there, can we?
He doesn't think the election was stolen.
What a heroic position. Wow.